Make America Great Again hat splitting the masses like the Red Sea. He'd hardly taken a step before Hillary was a distant afterthought. Trump's slow-moving cluster of press, security, and fans, I couldn't even call them supporters, not yet, holding their phones overhead, reaching out $100 bills for him to sign, dwarfed Hillary's blob. The same Iowans whom I'd seen trying to get a shot of Hillary's blonde bob in the agriculture building now angled to get close to Trump amid shouts of "Kick Hillary's ass" and "Trump that bitch!" I made an educated guess that Trump would also head for the pork chop truck and got in line, sucking in the scent of exhaust and cooking oil. I stood in line with a trio of college girls, all blondes in wind shorts that stuck to their tan thighs. None of them were for Hillary. "I don't trust anything she says," one of the girls told me. Two of them had already decided to vote for Trump. I could feel my forehead scrunching, my inner valley girl voice come out. "Seriously?" I thought for sure these girls were fucking with me or fucking with the democratic process or both. "Yeah, I don't like everything he says, but at least he says it like it is," one of the girls said. By the time I got back to the Hotel Fort Des Moines, it was dark outside, though the humidity hadn't let up. I took the rickety elevator with its "this way up" sign to the 8th floor. The door on room 817 was ajar. The smell of cigarette smoke and reefer floated through the open crack. Thinking I had the wrong room, I checked my key. Yep, room 817. I slowly pushed the door open to find a scene that looked like a meth den. Two men and one woman spread out on one of the double beds, sucking down cigarettes. The mattress on the other bed had been dragged to the floor, and two more men, both in undershirts, reclined on it, their eyes little slits. I noticed a luggage rack had been rolled in with a red ice chest full of Busch Light. One of the men on the bed, skinny, with a shaved head and a snake tattoo that peeked out from his collar, took a long drag and looked me up and down. "Can we help you?" "Yeah, I think this is my room." I flashed my key as if it were a badge. "It's our room now." I didn't want to escalate matters. I'd watched enough lock-up raw marathons to know he'd likely graduated from his cell at the Iowa State Penitentiary to my room at the Hotel Fort Des Moines. But for the past 4 months, I'd squeezed everything I needed in life into a single black roller bag. Carry-on size, because who has time to wait for checked baggage? I didn't see it. I'd already lost one of the diamond stud earrings Bobby had specially made in the jewelry district and given me for our first wedding anniversary, gone forever in the sheets of a Best Western at the Manchester airport or sucked into the vacuum at the Avis return. "Okay, well, can I just get my luggage?" I asked. "Haven't seen your luggage," the same man, the spokesman of the group, said. "All right, well, thanks anyway. I'll just check with the front desk. Enjoy your evening." I surprised myself with how chipper this came out. Downstairs, I banged on the bronze bell at the front desk. A petite woman with a flash of pink in her hair came out looking as if I'd woken her. "Hi, oh, thank God, there are people in my room, and my luggage is gone, and my phone died, and I need to call the police," and... She interrupted me, rubbing her eyes with the back of her wrist. "Room 817? "Yes, that's my room." "Oh, yeah, the Hilton only gave you one night, so I moved you out and said my friends could have the room. Let me get your stuff." She was polite, as if she'd given my room away to a make-a-wish kid, not a pile of tweakers. She turned around and came out a couple minutes later with my roller bag. I flung it on the floor and unzipped it. Passport, clothes, makeup, Kiehl's travel-size skin products, chargers, battery packs, backup battery packs, leather-bound journal, necklace my mom gave me before the campaign started with the bronze key that says Brave, Ziploc bags full of almonds and melatonin, all thrown about, pulled from their neat pockets, but all there. Chapter 18. Sorry, Not Sorry. North Las Vegas, August 2015. "Isn't leadership about taking responsibility?" Fox News' Ed Henry yelled with the grace of a livestock auctioneer. It was August in North Las Vegas, and the thermometer in Annie's rental car read 129 degrees. Hillary wore silky pants, a blouse, and pointy-toed shoes, all in exactly the same apricot hue. She'd finished a town hall that hadn't gone well. Nothing had gone particularly well, really, since the wingding. When an ebullient supporter asked if she could get a hug, Hillary told the woman, "Sit down right there. When I finish my Q&A, I will give you that hug, I promise." We didn't see if she delivered said hug, but after the town hall, Hillary strolled to the back of the gym to take our questions. "Look, Ed, I do take responsibility," she said. "I regret this has become such a cause celeb, but that doesn't change the facts." "Did you try to wipe the whole server?" Ed called out. "I don't. I have no idea. That's why we turned it over." "You were the official in charge of it. Did you wipe the server?" "What, like with a cloth or something?" Hillary said, rubbing the air as if she were applying Windex to an invisible window. When she stormed off, leaving a glass of hardly touched iced tea behind, an NBC News reporter yelled out, "Isn't this an indication that this issue isn't going to go away for the remainder of your campaign?" She threw a dismissive wave at us and said as she walked out an exit door and into the Las Vegas heat, "Nobody talks to me about it other than you guys." That night, the travelers all went for a Thai feast at the Lotus of Siam, a James Beard award-winning restaurant that shared a strip mall with a nail salon tanning parlor combo. When the pork larb arrived, spicy level 6, one of the regular travelers, without any malice or bias, proposed we go around the table and say whether we thought Hillary would win, starting it off with, "I don't think she's going to be president. I just don't. You go next." But the rest of us just looked down at our sticky rice and papaya salad, afraid to voice our opinions even in the anonymity of an off-strip Vegas restaurant. Ken Thomas finally said that as an AP reporter, he couldn't answer that question. And if the AP wouldn't do it, none of us would. As usual, I felt obligated to fill the silence, so I said something like, "Well, it's hers to lose." Had I answered the question honestly, I would have said, of course Hillary was going to win, and we would all be going to Washington in a year and a half to cover the FWP. Name one Republican who could beat her. But I probably would have also said that she needed to get her shit together ASAP. I wasn't the only one who felt that way. The Clintons had planned to spend the August doldrums at a beachside estate in Amagansett that cost $110,000 for a two-week stay, where they would bask in their wealthy friends' adoration while picking up $2,700 per person. Instead, the hedge fund manager and real estate magnate and fashion scion friends approached Bill and Hillary apoplectic about the campaign's inability to squelch the email controversy and Hillary's refusal to apologize. Bill, believing the whole thing a witch hunt, was emphatic that she had nothing to apologize for. Hillary blamed Brooklyn. On one conference call, Hillary cut Robbie Mook off. "I need a James Carville, not a George Stephanopoulos, defending me on this." The analogy confounded the newer aides, who didn't register the reference to the 1992 campaign. Robbie was a Vermont preteen with a budding interest in school plays when the Jennifer Flowers scandal broke and everyone agreed George had wimped out. Susan Thomas's, Hillary's chief defender back then, the Clintons' bad cop, as the Post called her, said Stephanopoulos was the squeamish guy of the century. "Ooh, ooh, I can't stand this campaign." I said, "Then quit. Your theatrics are just adorable, but quit. If you can't handle it, quit." Susan had multiple sclerosis now and was homebound. Hillary missed her. That was the kind of loyalty and defender she craved. Instead, she got a millennial armed with data and analytics. Hillary also reminded the newer aides about her fraught dynamic with the New York Times. She'd seen this movie before, she told them. "They'll absolutely hammer me over the emails, and then they'll give me the biggest wet kiss of an endorsement, and it won't matter by then," she said. After the election, Bill would spread a more creative Times conspiracy. The publisher had struck a deal with Trump that we'd destroy Hillary on her emails to help him get elected if he kept driving traffic and boosting the company's stock price. I don't want to blame the victim. We did all hyperventilate over her emails, but Hillary and her campaign never had a strategy to change the conversation. By my tally, Brooklyn turned down 47 of my interview requests, including to discuss Hillary's economic proposals, immigration, her work at the Children's Defense Fund, and her years as a working mother in Arkansas. My Times colleagues asked for interviews about women's issues, foreign policy, national security, among many other substantive topics. Any of those stories would have likely kicked emails off the front page, even if only briefly. Trump understood our gluttonous short attention span better than anyone, but especially better than Hillary, whose media strategy amounted to her ignoring us. But that August, Brooklyn knew it had to try something. When the Clintons got back to Chappaqua from the Hamptons, aides presented the Clintons with the findings from two pre-Labor Day focus groups. Voters liked when she'd shown contrition at a campaign stop in Iowa, saying her use of personal email clearly wasn't the best choice and "I take responsibility for that decision." They wanted more of that. Hillary mulled all this as she campaigned in New Hampshire over Labor Day weekend. She was more introspective than usual. When you run for office, it's a very challenging experience, Hillary said on a stop in Portsmouth. Democrats I talked to describe her campaign with a single stinging word, joyless. At the end of the press conference, Ruby Kramer said to Hillary she'd wanted to ask a question that wasn't about emails, but felt obligated to stick to the news. Oh, come on, liberate yourself and ask the question you want to ask, Hillary, ever the feminist, said. Ruby asked if she thought she was running a joyful campaign. I like getting out and talking and figuring out what's on people's minds, Hillary said. Then she hoisted her arms overhead and said in a you-can-all-go-fuck-yourselves tone, and off we go, joyfully. 3 days later, she apologized. It could have only happened with ABC News's David Muir. The guys aggressively shushed me ahead of the interview when they said how flirty Hillary was with Muir, and I replied that I'd heard he was gay. Shh, Hillary cannot know that, one of them said. For all the lesbian theories, Hillary enjoys nothing more than flirting with a handsome, preferably straight man. She constantly talks about how she married a husband more attractive than she is, which isn't really true, but it always told me a lot about Hillary that she thought it was. This flirty Hillary played out on the campaign trail. In Hanover, New Hampshire, she waxed nostalgic about a photographer she'd been set up with on a blind date in college, later describing him as artistic, and he was kind of poetic, and in those days, you know, you were choosing between anguished young men over art and anguished young men over Vietnam, and he was anguished over art and all that came with it. When a beefy, smooth-headed supporter in his mid-40s stood up to ask Hillary a question at a town hall in Oskaloosa, Iowa, Hillary interrupted, "I do think this bald look is pretty attractive." Even after the back and forth about her email server, Hillary loved to spar with Ed Henry. She would regularly look past her almost entirely female press corps to call on the Fox News correspondent with his cherub cheeks and poochy pocket squares. Whenever CNN's Dan Marica, who when he grew out his strawberry blonde beard vaguely resembled a young Bill Clinton, shouted an airy question at Hillary, she'd toss her head back and giggle and say, "Oh, Dan." After Chris Christie endorsed Trump, Dan decided to ask whether Hillary was jealous that she hadn't gotten Christie's backing. Brown Loafer's guy, who'd become friends with Dan as they were among the few men on the road, said of the subsequent exchange, she responded with a prolonged smile, you could see the gears turning, and then said, "Dan, I really like you. I really, really like you." They are basically courting each other at this point. Brooklyn had tested Hillary's body language with various options for anchors to conduct the apology interview. Focus groups really responded to the ease she projected sitting across from Muir, named one of People magazine's Sexiest Men Alive 2014. If she had to apologize, at least she could do it with an interviewer who didn't make her look as if she wanted to hurl across the divide and suffocate the life out of them with her bare hands, as she had looked with Andrea Mitchell and CNN's Breonna Keeler. Breonna had been selected for the first sit-down interview of the campaign in a mix-up after Huma told the press team, without specifying, HRC wants the blonde. They hadn't been sure which blonde and chose the one who covered the campaign. Press aides in Brooklyn buried their faces in their hands when Mitchell asked on MSNBC if the email server had been a mistake, and Hillary said, "I'm sorry that this has been confusing to people." She gave a similar non-apology to the AP. With Muir, Hillary finally dropped the ambiguities. "I think in retrospect, certainly, as I look back on it now, even though it was allowed, I should have used two accounts, one for personal, one for work-related emails. That was a mistake. I'm sorry about that. I take responsibility." Later that afternoon, I pulled some strings from my old beat covering media to get seats at the Ellen DeGeneres Show, 3 rows from the temporary stage, set up above the ice skating rink at Rockefeller Center. Maybe it was all the talk of girl power or the adoration from the other celebrity guests, including Amy Schumer, plus roller skates, Pink, and a 5-year-old presidential history buff in a miniature version of Hillary's pantsuit. But when Ellen asked about the email controversy, Hillary had already reverted. "I'm sorry for all the confusion that has ensued," she said. Chapter 19, The Pied Piper. Hot Springs, Arkansas, August 2015. Brooklyn called him the Pied Piper, a charismatic showman who could drive the Republican rats out of the race. We don't want to marginalize the more extreme candidates, but make them more Pied Piper candidates, who actually represent the mainstream of the Republican Party, read an early strategy memo to the DNC. We need to be elevating the Pied Piper candidates, including Trump, Ben Carson, and Ted Cruz, so that they are leaders of the pack and tell the press to take them seriously. An agenda for an upcoming campaign meeting sent by Robbie Mook's office asked, how do we maximize Trump? For the first 10 months of her campaign, Hillary went around the country propping up Trump, portraying him as the unbridled id of the GOP. After Trump called Mexican immigrants rapists and criminals, Hillary told Democrats in Little Rock, there's nothing funny about the hate he is spewing at immigrants and their families. But she quickly added that Trump was merely saying in harsh terms what the rest of the GOP candidates believe. The sad truth is, if you look at many of their policies, it can be hard to tell the difference. Joel Benenson must have told me 15 times they're all cut from the same cloth. Paul Begala, the affable Texan via New Jersey, known as the yin to James Carville's yang in 92, told me Trump would help Hillary for a variety of reasons by exposing the GOP as the radical right-wing anger society it has become. He argued the GOP's problem is not Mr. Trump, it is the extreme and angry nature of their base. The first time I saw Trump, he was wearing a tuxedo. He had Melania on his arm, and they wove through the banquet tables decorated with white ranunculus and tea candles under the domed ceiling of the New York Public Library. I was a Condé Nast rover, and an executive asked me to drop off a fat white envelope to an editor at table 2. I placed the envelope on the tablecloth and beelined for the exit before I could grab a flute of champagne or try the blini coated with caviar and creme fraiche. I was leaving the gala just as Trump arrived. There was something about seeing him that gave me the sense I'd reached a milestone of New York transplants. There's no going back to Peoria after you've been at the same party as Donald J. Trump, even if I was the help. Our paths crossed several times after that, when I covered Hollywood for the Journal and he was promoting The Apprentice. Then in 2013, Trump and Ivanka scheduled a lunch in an executive dining room at the New York Times to talk to business reporters about the Trump Organization. No masthead editors or political reporters signed up. Each time someone asked a substantive question about, say, P&L on the post office hotel conversion in Washington or net revenue on licensing agreements in China, Trump would give a couple-word hyperbolic answer. It's going to be the best, and then swivel his head left to Ivanka, who would then respond in impressive granular detail, sometimes pulling slides and charts out of a camel-colored Ivanka-branded tote. Afterward, I shook Trump's hand and rushed back to my desk, feeling that I'd had a nice break from cafeteria food to chat with a reality TV star and his pretty, capable daughter. And the day Trump announced he was running, I admitted to a couple of Times editors that I'd watched 8 seasons of The Apprentice and that we should do a story about it. They told me politics reporters wouldn't be writing about Trump. We have enough candidates to cover, one editor said. Let the TV writers do it. Months later, it got back to Trump that I'd watched his TV show. He was already the Republican nominee, and he called to ask me if I thought Arnold Schwarzenegger would be as good as he was on The Apprentice. I don't think so. I don't know, I responded, cautious that anything I said could be used against me. I don't really have time to watch anymore. Then there was our Polish housekeeper, Wanda, who is so bad at her job that a couple of friends who've also used her for years came home early once to find Wanda watching TV in their bed. But she is a solid person and charges $80 to clean a 2-bedroom apartment, including laundry. She also happened to clean Don Jr.'s and Eric Trump's New York apartments. In 2014, Eric and Laura invited Wanda to their wedding at Mar-a-Lago, which, despite what anyone thinks about the Trump sons, was a class act thing to do. I was in Little Rock in July 2015 to cover Hillary's speech to the annual Jefferson Jackson Democratic fundraising dinner. I hadn't seen Trump as a candidate yet, so I arrived a day early and drove an hour to Hot Springs, a quaint redneck spa town in the Ouachita Mountains where Bill spent his childhood. Trump was the keynote speaker at an Arkansas GOP dinner. Annie Carney and I got there early and wandered around the Hot Springs Convention Center trying to find Trump's press conference. Beautifully dressed African-American families, little girls in Easter egg pink dresses, their mothers in starling blue lace dresses with matching hats and handbags filled the hallways. We were so confused. Why are they supporting Trump? I asked. That's when a voice announced, "The Regional Convention of Jehovah's Witnesses is next door at the Bank of the Ozarks Arena. I repeat, next door." Trump walked into the drab conference room soaked in sweat. There were about a dozen of us, mostly local press. There was none of the commotion of a Hillary press conference. We all stood around casually ready for our Friday night entertainment. "Ah, it's nice and cool in here," Trump said, dabbing his drenched forehead with crinkled Kleenexes he'd pulled out from his suit pocket. A couple of dandruff-sized white dots stuck to his forehead and temples like snowflakes on orange astroturf. I couldn't believe it. Not only did Hillary never sweat, even if she did, her team would have never allowed her to do something as Bush League as wipe her sweat in front of the press. Trump flicked his wrist at a couple of photographers. "How about you go over there? You don't need to see towels on my face." He reminded us several times that he owned some of the greatest real estate assets in the world. He declared, "I have a great relationship with the Mexican people." And he wasted little time calling Arianna Huffington a terrible woman and a major, major source of problems for a lot of people, especially her ex-husband. I remembered crashing the Teneo holiday party earlier that year. Declan Kelly, an Irish PR man and Hillary donor whom she rewarded with a State Department position, co-founded the firm with Doug Band. They offered corporate clients access to what Band called Bill Clinton Inc. The guys called Declan a fucking leprechaun. At the party, held coincidentally at Trump's favorite haunt, the 21 Club, Declan kept talking about how Teneo offers global solutions in a borderless world. That's when a prominent New York Democrat leaned over and whispered in my ear, "You can't sell air forever." And that's what popped in my head as I listened to Trump talk that night. You can't sell air forever. I couldn't think of anything else, so I asked the Donald what he thought of Hillary's plan to offer tax incentives to companies that share profits with employees. Hillary Clinton unveiled her economic plan. Part of that was profit sharing. I wanted to know what you think of her plan. Do you share profits with employees? You can take the girl out of the Wall Street Journal. I stopped transcribing, or really even listening, after he repeated for the third time some variation of, "I've had so many great employees, many of them Hispanics." Then he shifted. "You have to understand Hillary." That perked me up. After all, I'd spent most of my adult life trying to understand Hillary. "Wall Street is backing Hillary. Guys I know very well from New York. They're pouring money into her campaign. They're doing it for one reason, so don't be misled by Hillary." Then he made a puppet motion, altering his diminutive hands up and down as if they were pulling the strings of a Hillary marionette. "She's totally controlled by people that love China." Up, down. "They will totally control Hillary, just like a puppet. Up, down, up, down." Trump didn't steal Bernie's line of attack. He had it in his head all along. A couple of weeks later in early August, the Travelers, united by the quiet drudgery of covering the Hillary campaign, convinced her communications director, Jen Palmieri, to let us watch the first Republican primary debate with the campaign staff over pepperoni pizza at the Brooklyn HQ. "Come on, you can spin us in real time," I argued. We dug into the Domino's boxes, half-listening as Carly Fiorina obliterated Bobby Jindal, Rick Santorum, and the other minor GOP candidates. I knew that Carly would get her 15 minutes. A lot of what came out of her mouth was borderline crazy, but I still admired Carly's ballsy self-delusion. As Vonnegut wrote, "We are what we pretend to be." In 2010, I was writing a WSJ magazine profile on Carly's U.S. Senate race, and we'd road-tripped up the California coast together. She'd just recovered from breast cancer and jumped into a Senate race against Barbara Boxer. She brushed off her abysmal record at HP and even portrayed her primary opponent as a demon sheep with glowing red eyes and what remains the strangest attack ad in the pantheon of political programming. Carly and I got trashed together at the Madonna Inn, me on a house red and Carly on martinis, extra dry, in a Pepto-Bismol pink leather booth at the Gold Rush Steakhouse. We then laughed our way back to our suites with their faux brick fireplaces. I thought maybe, despite their partisan differences, Hillary would have some feminist pride that a female candidate was standing up to Trump while wiping the debate floor with every other GOP candidate. Nope. Hillary despised her. One of the reasons I'm really excited to be working on this campaign is because we are making history to elect the first woman president, Hillary Clinton. Robbie Mook said when I asked if Hillary was proud that a woman stood out on the Republican side. It's always been like that with Hillary. Feminism is conditional. Elizabeth Dole, she is the woman people think Hillary is, Diane Blair wrote when Dole ran for the Republican nomination in 1999. When the main GOP debate came on, everyone pushed their pizza crust aside and stared transfixed at the TV, set up on a stand in front of the room like substitute teacher day in middle school. During commercial breaks, Robbie would pop in to talk to the travelers. He salivated when the debate came back on and Trump started to speak. "Shh," Robbie said, practically pressing his nose up to the TV. "I've got to get me some Trump." Robbie thought Rubio would be the nominee. Podesta was bullish on Kasich. Bill and Hillary, still stuck in the 1990s, feared the Bush surname most of all. As the third GOP debate approached, Brooklyn assured us all that the strategy was working. Hillary had elevated Trump, using him to weaken the rest of the Republicans. Voters were starting to tune in, and the Trump sheen would soon fade. "He's a summer fling," senior aides kept telling me. It was mid-October. Chapter 20. Spontaneity is embargoed until 4 p.m. Manchester, November 2015. No matter how hard I try, I can only see Manchester through the filter of soot that sat on the windowsill of my rented Subaru. The city is a dusky, weary, unfussy place split in two by the spiky banks of the Merrimack River. It's too far from Boston, where I'd flown into early that morning, to be part of its ex-urban sprawl, but too close to have the charm of rural New England. It was November, a year before the general election. I pulled the collar of my jacket tight around my neck and shivered on the short walk up the parking garage ramps and into J.D.'s Tavern, the sports bar attached to the lobby of the Radisson, where Hillary would soon arrive to share drinks, bar snacks, and some strained small talk with her traveling press. In the 7 months she'd been a candidate, Hillary only had one off-the-record drinking session with her traveling press. I hadn't been in Iowa and missed it. But I heard a TV journalist made the rookie mistake of asking how she met Bill, allowing Hillary to filibuster with a story so immortalized in memoirs and speeches and popular Clinton lore that I could recite it verbatim. "Oh gosh, it was 1971 at the Yale Law Library." The interactions I had with Hillary since the campaign started had almost all happened by accident. In September, she'd stopped in at the Union Diner in Laconia to shake hands. She met a high school French teacher who introduced Hillary to half a dozen of her students, who all wanted a photo. I stood to her left, and when Hillary pivoted to make sure she'd posed with all the students, she looked at me and said, "She's not in the class. This one I know. She's not in the class. She may speak French, but she's not in the class." Shortly before that encounter, I'd written a story looking ahead to the fall. I interviewed aides in the Brooklyn headquarters about their new efforts to bring spontaneity to a candidacy that sometimes seemed wooden and overly cautious. The campaign brass wanted to put the summer of discontent behind them. The guys came through by providing me with an interview with Robbie and Jen. I'd hardly left the building when the guys hosted a conference call with the entire press corps, telling everyone almost exactly what they'd told me, minus the part where Robbie joked that the high point of the campaign had been my favorable front-page profile of him. I always recorded interviews and took handwritten notes, starring anything that stood out. That way, when I listened back to the audio, I could glance at my illegible scribble and see which quotes had stood out during the conversation and what I may not have picked up on in the moment. On the subway back to Midtown, I plugged in my earphones and listened to my Sony voice recorder, the one I'd bought 8 years earlier in Shinjuku with the Japanese writing on the side. Everything I thought I could build a story around seemed stale now that the top campaign aides had given the same talking points to the rest of the press. Toward the middle of the audio, we discussed how Hillary would try to show voters her softer, more personable side. It was the only original reporting I had. That evening, I sat in Carolyn's office, watching as she scrunched her forehead and lowered her reading glasses to edit my story. I could tell how rough a day she was having based on the number of empty Diet Coke cans and the font size on her screen. Carolyn cut and pasted entire paragraphs, plucking the juiciest Yorkie details, like the campaign's recognition that the everyday American's phrase wasn't resonating, out of a mumble of politicalese. Our favorability is higher than any Republican. Even as I reminded myself that a Carolyn edit always made even the dullest stories jump off the page, reading over her shoulder still gave me the reticent, disembodied feeling of a patient watching a surgeon perform an operation on their vital organs. When she'd stitched it all back together, she shot me a playback, what we called the edited version of a story, and sent it on to the copy editor, who debated me about whether we needed to explain what Hillary's bowl off against Ellen DeGeneres meant. "I think it's obvious," I replied. The front page headline read, "Hillary to show more humor and heart, aides say." The backlash was immediate. Today's New York Times story on HRC read more like The Onion, her detailed plan to show more authenticity and spontaneity, hashtag just do it, former Obama advisor David Axelrod tweeted. The hashtag I'm with her crowd always assumed the campaign disliked my coverage because of her emails or my reporting on the Clinton Foundation. But that wasn't it. It was the Yorkie and bathroom gate, and that the day she declared her candidacy, I'd written that she hadn't offered a clear rationale for why she was running. Hillary hated that I'd broken the news that the mysterious Diane Reynolds in her private State Department emails had been Chelsea writing under her preferred pseudonym. But nothing put Hillary over the edge quite like the humor and heart story. Donors and top Democrats called her campaign to complain. Jen and Robbie took most of Hillary's wrath, but the guys got it too for letting me into Brooklyn in the first place. The fall, when Hillary was supposed to restart, instead became what some Democrats called the spontaneity is embargoed until 4 p.m. phase of the campaign. That's the thing about being a candidate reporter. You can't hide. If Hillary had to learn to be an inflatable bop bag bouncing back after whatever the traveling press threw at her that day, the guys were a cement wall, rough and unyielding and able to block me from receiving basic logistical information or asking a question. Ever since the humor and heart piece, I'd been iced out. At an event at the New Hampshire State House before driving to Hanover, Wyndham, and ending the day in Manchester, Hillary and Brown Loafers displayed a superhuman cold shoulder, looking right past my multiple shouts of, "Secretary! Secretary!" Instead, Hillary answered a question about why Trump got better ratings than she did on SNL. Consider the performance. And adding insult to injury, she called on Fox News twice. Obama handled this dynamic differently. Back in August 2008, I wrote a Weekend Journal feature about presidents and body image and whether an overweight electorate could relate to Obama given his intense workout schedule and 0% body fat. Not The Onion. Okay, so it was an inane idea and I was widely mocked. The headline, "Too Fit to be President," and Murdoch's recently buying the paper didn't help matters. Later that day, the press pool trailed Obama to a roadside farmer's market in Florida. He ordered a strawberry milkshake, and as he took a long sip, he looked right at me. We locked eyes as he gulped down the frothy mix. Then he said, "Wow, this milkshake is delicious. Maybe if I had one of these every day, I wouldn't be such a skinny guy." Obama then ordered strawberry milkshakes for the entire press corps. I can safely say Hillary didn't want to buy me a milkshake that day in New Hampshire. On the upside, my reporting was right. She started to phase out everyday Americans. She had a new favorite line, "Get ahead and stay ahead." Asked about the email server, I will continue doing my part for transparency. I'm also going to focus on what's most important, helping families get ahead and stay ahead. Pressed to release the transcripts of her Wall Street speeches, "I have plans that will actually help families get ahead and stay ahead." Teary stories at a town hall about the toll of the state's opioid epidemic would often be answered with, "We need to make sure every child can get ahead and stay ahead." Hillary still treated New Hampshire like the womb, a safe, cozy place that made Bill the comeback kid in 1992 and resuscitated her own campaign in 2008. 7 years later, she poured herself into the state, feeling as though she knew the place. She said she knew she'd never get the angry voters, the ones who wanted to send Wall Street bankers and CEOs and anyone with a Peloton bicycle to the guillotine. When a mid-level spokesman drafted a statement that said Hillary wouldn't stop until everyday families can get ahead and stay ahead no matter who gets in her way, the campaign brass replied, Too much with the no matter who gets in her way, so would drop that. Hillary remained convinced that the country hadn't changed that much while she'd been at the State Department. She was confident she could sway the convincible, rosier voters even if they disliked her. "Hey guys, be angry, and then let's roll up our sleeves and get to work," she told students at New England College. "Anger is a powerful emotion, but it's not a plan." She told aides that during these town halls, she could see voters' posture change as she explained her practical solutions to help them get ahead and stay ahead. Shoulders would relax, arms would unfurl, scowls would soften. She had this. What she didn't realize at the time, and what I didn't grasp either until Bernie beat her in New Hampshire by 22 points, was that getting ahead doesn't mean anything to people who have nowhere to go. I myself was so influenced by having seen firsthand how New Hampshire had saved Hillary back in 2008 that, despite signs Bernie would win, I too believed she had a lock on the state. And she'd had such a masterful turn in the first Democratic debate in Vegas that the Democrats who had hankered for Biden promptly decided there was no path for the Veep. Bernie had done Hillary a favor in declaring that people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails. In contrast to her demeanor that summer, she seemed breezy and sociable that fall in New Hampshire, which was why, after a Fighting for Us town hall at a high school in Windham, Brownloafer sent an email around saying the secretary would like us to join her for OTR drinks in Manchester. She used to do these things all the time. When I think about Hillary in 2008, I don't see her on the debate stage or working the rope line at a Lions Club. Instead, she is gliding between the aisles of the Hill Force One toward the press, a goblet of yellowtail in one hand and balancing the other against the back of an AP reporter's seat. In 2008, her traveling press corps was largely populated by New York guys who covered Hillary as a senator for the tabloids. The New York Post, Newsday, The Daily News, The Observer, all had reporters on the plane. 8 years later, none of them did. In an interview I did with Mel Brooks once, he described Dick Cavett as astonishingly non-Jewish. He thought the borscht belt was something you wore. I always thought of Hillary like that, astonishingly non-Jewish. But she kept up with these mostly Jewish jokesters and would often show her sardonic side, directed on more than one occasion at Rudy Giuliani and an African dictator's alleged STD. And a quick wit, even when the topics of masturbation and ferrets came up. She seemed in favor of the former, against the latter. She even revealed a romantic side, offering nut-covered chocolates on Valentine's Day and calling reporters girlfriends. I want to personally apologize to you that Fernando's with me and not you on Valentine's Day. At one off-the-record drinking session with the traveling press in the Woodline Bar of the William Penn Hotel in downtown Pittsburgh, Hillary had been so candid over Blue Moon and Oranges, her preferred beer, that when she left, we jotted down Hillary haiku, passing around cocktail napkins and each adding a line, confessions in 5 to 7 syllables. Pittsburgh campaign stop. Blue Moon pints with oranges. I killed Vince Foster. In fact, I doubt I would have been so drawn to covering Hillary's second presidential campaign had it not been for seeing her in these settings, which had led to the dopey notion that I had unique insight into who she really was. "You just don't understand what she's like in private," I'd tell anyone who would listen after the 2008 primary. Another favorite observation, Obama's charming and charismatic to 50,000 people, but Hillary is just as charming and charismatic to 5. But that 2008 image of Hillary had faded by the fall of her second campaign. At times we were so bored and desperate for stories that we analyzed Hillary's head gestures. "Look at that, wow, she is nodding up a storm," John Heilman, then of Bloomberg Politics, said on his cable show. Mark Halperin agreed. "Almost a minute's worth during not a very long event." The Times tallied 43 head nods per minute in a discussion about community banking in Cedar Falls. This created a vicious cycle. Hillary looked at her 16 press corps and thought we were hopelessly young and driven entirely by clicks and the financial demands on our struggling news outlets. The head-nodding stories admittedly didn't help matters. She missed her high-minded State Department press corps, worldly, substantive reporters who didn't care about the horse race, understood the intricacies of Hillary's plan to arm the moderate Syrian rebels, and could find Kyrgyzstan on the map. In the White House, Hillary once said that had her press corps been all women, she might do what Eleanor Roosevelt did and hold 340 press conferences. That made a big impression on me, Hillary told reporters in 1994 after answering an hour of questions about her cattle futures at the famous Pretty in Pink press conference. Now, Miss Roosevelt only invited women reporters. I don't think I could get away with that. 22 years later, Hillary had an almost entirely female press corps, and she wouldn't have even known our names had it not been for the Facebook. The campaign's press shop assembled an album with all our faces, names, and news outlets. Hillary studied the Facebook with her briefings, not so that she could occasionally say, "Hi, Tamara," or "How are you today, Monica?" or "Good morning, Hannah," but so that she wouldn't mistake us for voters and, God forbid, accidentally interact with us when we approached her on the rope line. The thing about a mostly female press corps was that Hillary likes men, preferably the damaged, witty, brilliant kind. She told aides she knew women reporters would be harder on her. We'd be jealous and catty and more spiteful than men. We'd be impervious to her flirting. We were so starved for information that on the rare occasion when brown loafers did come by to brief us, we'd behave with such giddy commotion you'd think he was a Chippendales dancer at a bachelorette party. We'd swarm him, waiting to be fed. Brown loafers would tell us, off the record, not for attribution, that Hillary planned to be in Council Bluffs and Sioux City on Friday, and we'd respond with, "Thanks so much for the guidance, and absolutely we'll consider this off the record. And can we do this again?" as if we'd been exclusively fed front-page headlines like "Hillary to file for divorce" or "Hillary fearing defeat to withdraw from Iowa." Definitely not "Hillary to talk about how the economy can work for everyone in Council Bluffs." I could have taken the journalistic high ground and refused to attend the OTR in Manchester, calling it a night at the Holiday Inn Express with some takeout from the Uno Pizzeria and a heaping side of righteous indignation about how cozy the rest of the travelers were. But the truth was I wanted to cover Hillary as a real person, and to do that I needed a reminder that she was more than the tentative candidate with the tight grin whom I'd watched from a distance for months. The carpeted dining room at J.D.'s Tavern, up a few steps from the sunken bar area, smelled of cooking oil and malt. The room was quiet, with just a few men sipping beers and the white noise of hockey highlights on an overhead TV when we all stormed in. "I had that spot saved. What the fuck? Did somebody move my laptop? Guys, where do we think HRC will sit? Where did she sit the last time in Iowa? In the middle, but not exactly in the middle. Sort of to the left. Your left or my left? I don't know. It was a different setup." It was like reporter roulette, everyone taking our best bet about where Hillary would sit and then banking our wide asses and puffer coats on it. The trick had been to try to position ourselves close enough to make eye contact. The worst seats were the ones several spots away from her but on the same side of the table, making it nearly impossible for Hillary to see you as we all packed in shoulder to shoulder like school kids playing Red Rover. "Let Hillary come over." Pitchers of the local Smutty Nose beer, a staple in Hillary's stump speech ever since she toured the brewery and held a roundtable discussion on small business development with the owners, "I always drink Smutty Nose when I'm in New Hampshire." And platters of crispy buffalo wings, flatbread, and other assorted starters sat in the center of the wooden tables for four that were pushed together to form one long, boxy table, so wide we had to lift up out of our chairs and lean over our plates to grab the appetizers, dangling our press credentials in puddles of queso and marinara sauce. I got a seat towards the middle and didn't move again until Hillary had come and gone. I don't remember seeing her come in, but from the very first, "Hi, everyone, where should I sit?" I could tell she would have rather been testifying before the Benghazi committee. She took a quick survey of the two open seats, both of which happened to be to my right. She noticed me, said hello, and took a seat, one away from me and next to Jen Epps of Bloomberg. That left the spot to my right for brown loafers, who formed a physical barrier in a button-down shirt and leather-trimmed messenger bag between Hillary and me. A martini glass appeared in front of her, placed next to an untouched pint of Smutty Nose. I noticed her hands, the sunspots of a grandmother, the neat, buffed nails, the modest wedding band, and the gold chain-link charm bracelet with a tiny photo of her granddaughter, Charlotte, hanging down. Seeing her scrape the cheese off her flatbread and then leave the bread on the plate, I mention the Whole 30, a starvation diet of 30 days of no sugar, no starches, no dairy, and no alcohol that several reporters in the Hillary press, including me, were trying to stick to with varying degrees of success. She shook her head, hadn't heard of it. I can't say that she was ever impolite, but she delivered some soul-crushing and not entirely unfounded criticism of the political press. We were essentially gossip peddlers, uninterested in policies that affect people's lives, and too dim and driven by traffic and Twitter mentions to grasp said policies, even if we wanted to. At least, that's how I interpreted it. Brown loafers would probably characterize things differently. Without our knowledge, he recorded these off-the-record sessions and sent transcripts around the campaign, the highlights of which a source shared with me. Relations between Hillary and the press had been rocky since the start of the campaign, but that evening she exuded a particularly icy aloofness and a how-long-do-I-have-to-talk-to-you-assholes demeanor that made me feel as if I'd never been born. A younger TV reporter, less cynical than I was, later compared her disappointment in Hillary's phony response about Biden mulling a run. You know, I didn't even think about that. I've got enough to think about. To learning Santa Claus wasn't real. All I could think about was something I'd read in Diane Blair's journal. HC says press has big egos and no brains. When the conversation started to lull, a pile of discarded bread on her plate and an empty martini glass, Hillary looked over at Brown loafers, who nodded in unspoken obedience. She patted the table with both palms and exhaled something like, "Okay, should we get going?" The next morning, I woke up in my ground floor room at the Holiday Inn Express, feeling like a teenage girl just expelled from the pep squad. A tiny sliver of muted sunlight and the sound of passing cars came through the vinyl curtains. Still underneath the sheets and smelling the powdered eggs at the free breakfast buffet around the corner, I called Bobby, who was already at work and, unlike me, hardly ever complained. I moaned, "She really, really hates me." Even as I whined, full of self-pity, a part of me realized my dejection made perfect sense. Between bathroom gate and the Biden story and spontaneity is embargoed until 4 p.m., why on earth would Hillary like me? And yet for the first time in 7 years, I woke up clear-eyed and a little sad that ours was destined to be an impossible, tortured, and unrelentingly tense relationship, weighted down by old grudges and fresh grievances. To Hillary, I was a big ego with no brain, and no amount of cordial small talk could make up for the bad blood between her world and mine. "Not been good at press relations," Diane Blair wrote. "Feels intensely about zone of privacy, constantly betrayed and abused." On the drive back to Boston on I-93 to fly back to New York, my windshield wipers smeared a layer of icy grime. Right, left, right, left. And the defroster drowned out a public radio program about interest rates. I thought of Jill Abramson before she was ousted as executive editor, sitting on a bar stool in front of an upstairs window at an Irish pub across from the Port Authority bus terminal. She was offering career advice to a group of young women journalists. There were the usual concerns about work-life blah-blah-blah balance, and a lament that Albany seemed impossible to cover with a D-cup. "They just assume you're sleeping with your sources," somebody said, and all the less endowed girls looked down at their Pinot Grigios. When a sheepish reporter asked how to come to terms with the distinctly female instinct to always want to be liked while also writing the tough stories, Jill looked her in the eyes and said in her slow, deliberate way, "I always thought you're either hated or you're irrelevant." When I got back to the newsroom, I wrote the words, "You're either hated or you're irrelevant," down in black Sharpie on a yellow sticky note that I kept taped to the center of my computer screen for the rest of the campaign. Chapter 21. Schlonged. Lower East Side, Manhattan, December 2015. 3 days before Christmas, Hillary Clinton gave Donald Trump a gift. The back and forth went like this. Trump told a Grand Rapids, Michigan rally of presumably non-Yiddish speakers that Hillary got schlonged during the 2008 primaries. He also called her bathroom break during a Democratic debate in New Hampshire disgusting. Hillary told the Des Moines Register, It's not the first time he's demonstrated a penchant for sexism. Maggie Haberman and I wrote a front-page story about how Hillary hoped to use Trump's comments to energize women voters, who really should have already been energized, but that's another story. Brooklyn mobilized its network. Democrats called Trump a sexist practitioner of pathetic frat boy politics, more suited to run for president of the fourth-grade football team. Communications Director Jen Palmieri tweeted that she wouldn't respond to Trump, but everyone who understands the humiliation this degrading language inflicts on women should. Hashtag I'm with her. Our story had just published when Trump fired a cryptic warning shot. Hillary, when you complain about a penchant for sexism, who are you referring to? I have great respect for women. Be careful. He didn't say Bill Clinton's name. He didn't have to. Hillary had, in very senior editor's words, poked the crazy bear that is Trump. The strategy came right out of Roger J. Stone Jr.'s raunchy, rumor-filled book, The Clinton's War on Women. Scoops are not my forte. I prefer lunch-based reporting. I usually hear something newsy, let it percolate through a dessert course, and then sit on it for several days as I craft a feature around it. But I do have a knack for convincing a range of sources to leak me books prior to publication. 7 days after Hillary declared herself a champion for everyday Americans, a source slid under my front doormat a copy of Clinton Cash, the partisan investigation into the Clintons' wealth that Breitbart News had baked up. A couple months before Trump's warning shot, another source emailed me, subject line, Merry Christmas. Attached, I found a PDF of Stone's 476 pages of X-rated allegations against the former first couple, including kinky sex, obviously, drugs, prostitution, and an Arkansas scheme to sell HIV-positive prisoners' blood to global plasma traffickers. And happy Hanukkah, I wrote back. Stone, a Republican operative with white hair, a tattoo of Nixon's face spread across the expanse of his often exposed back, an Upper East Side apartment packed with Le Corbusier furniture and more shoes than Imelda Marcos, we did have that in common, had it out for me. I heard that he'd said I did most of my reporting on Bill Clinton while on my knees, among other choice descriptions. It was in this period that I started to develop a distant solidarity with Monica Lewinsky. In the book, Stone wrote, reporters like New York Times' Amy Chozick mistakenly think that Hillary Clinton has a lock on women voters that will send her to the White House. It wasn't lost on me that even as Hillary hated me, Stone accused me of being on the Clintons' payroll. Ah, balance. I wrote a brief post about the book, but my editors said Stone's allegations were too over the top, unproven, and conspiratorial to have any real impact on the election. They decided not to publish. I agreed. Less than 24 hours after Trump's initial tweet, I was taking a rare nap. It was Christmas Eve, and I planned to cook Bobby an Irish dinner, which meant heating up pre-made turkey and ham, boiling potatoes, and some stovetop stuffing. Being Irish and married to me, Bobby didn't have high culinary standards. I woke up an hour later and my phone was exploding. I had hundreds of new Twitter followers and a stream of text messages. The texts came from second cousins and high school friends in Texas and from at least two senators, one sitting cabinet secretary, and a former Wall Street Journal colleague in Hong Kong. My first thought was that I must have inserted a terrible mistake into our story. My career was over. Then I saw real Donald Trump's tweet. Third-rate reporters Amy Chozick and Maggie Haberman of the failing NY Times are totally in the Hillary circle of bias. Think about Bill. Trump sat back and waited. Had Hillary responded to his threats or continued to say he had a penchant for sexism, he may have abandoned Stone's strategy. But Hillary went silent. A close Trump aide later summed it up to me. He knew he could throw Bill's past back at her and she couldn't say a word. Who knows? Maybe he could even win white women. With a couple of days before New Year's and the Bill is a rapist meme ratcheting up, I emailed Trump to ask if he was an imperfect messenger, given his own very public infidelities and his ex-wife Ivana recently denying rumors of assault charges against him. I believe that I am the perfect messenger, Trump replied, because I fully understand life and all its wrinkles. I forwarded this response to my editors with the very professional subject line, OMG. Chapter 22. I am driving long distances in Iowa and may be slower to respond. Iowa, January 2016. A lot was made about Hillary's predominantly female press corps dubbed the girls on the bus. On any given day, in our cohort of about 20 regular travelers, as many as 18 of us were women. Politico did a story on the phenomenon. Vogue profiled us. This involved Irina Alexander, an elfin Los Angeles-based freelance writer, accompanying me to an Applebee's in Polk County. The headline asked, "Have female journalists ended the boys on the bus era of campaign reporting?" Short answer, no. We didn't even have a bus. For the first 10 months of the campaign, I was girl in a rental car. I'd spent so much time in a rental car, trying to chase Hillary's motorcade while fighting the urge to check Twitter and my overflowing inbox, that for my own safety and the safety of others, I set my out-of-office to read, "I am driving long distances in Iowa and may be slower to respond." On a nearly 3-hour drive back to Des Moines from Monticello, with Ruby Kramer in the passenger seat and Maggie Haberman on speaker, a state trooper pulled over my silver Ford Focus. He said I was speeding. And swerving. As he walked to the driver's side window and shined his flashlight inside, Ruby and I both thrust our hands up in a "don't shoot" motion. "You can put your hands down, ladies. I'm not going to shoot you," he said. He entered my driver's license into the system and issued me a warning. The prospect of not speeding again in Iowa seemed pretty slim. In New Hampshire, I'd almost driven into a frozen lake, trying to keep up with the Scooby van and motorcade in a torrential downpour while navigating the state's obscene amount of seemingly unnecessary traffic circles. What did New England have against a simple stop sign? When it got so dark I couldn't see the road, I pulled into a Holiday Inn Express. Then there was the Hummer that dinged me at the wing ding, an incident that made me even more uneasy behind the wheel. Lately, each time I got behind the wheel, my mind raced. I could see the truck that would sideswipe me, its oncoming headlights, the cornfield where some poor state trooper would find my body. I even imagined how the guys would react. Would they feel remorse? Or would they say good riddance, as they had when the Rolling Stones journalist Michael Hastings died in a single car crash at age 33? "Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy," one of the guys said. Then on a Tuesday in mid-January, Braden Joplin, a 25-year-old from Midland, Texas, with a newly grown beard and tender brown eyes, died at 4:30 p.m. CST in the Nebraska Medical Center's trauma unit. I read all the details. The driver lost control of the van that was carrying Joplin and three other Ben Carson campaign volunteers between events on an icy stretch of I-80 near Atlantic, Iowa, causing the van to careen over the median and collide with an oncoming Chevrolet Avalanche. I urged the campaign to get us a press bus. In 2008, the travelers all rode together in a press bus paid for by our news outlets and coordinated by Jamie, the Clinton campaign press wrangler, whom we all came to adore. The 2008 crew so settled into our bus that we'd each mark our territory with power cords and raggedy scarves. Any newcomers outside our established cliques would be destined for the landfill seats, what we called the back row of seats sandwiched between the trash and the toilet. But 8 years later, Robbie didn't want to spend money on a Jamie-like staffer. At least, that's what the campaign told us. From the start, hired gun guy told us, as if in a studied trance, the same thing about Robbie. "That Robbie, what a tightwad. Man, he is cheap. He's such a bean counter." There were carefully placed stories about Podesta riding a $30 vamoose bus between D.C. and New York. Robbie's cheapness was supposed to signal to donors that there would be none of the lavish flourishes of Hillary's 08 effort, which ended so in debt that she had to loan her campaign $13 million of her own money, an experience that made her a real coupon clipper in 16. There would be no chartered helicopter, no $95,000 spent on sandwich platters for caucus night parties when there was nothing to celebrate. No splurging $3,000 on 600 snow shovels for elderly caucus goers when the forecast didn't call for snow, and any self-respecting Iowan already owned their own snow shovel, thank you very much, New Yorkers. But once again, Hillary's biggest missteps of 2016 stemmed from trying to prove she learned from mistakes in 2008. Robbie's penny-pinching meant organizers and volunteers in Ohio and Florida had to go to Walmart to buy clipboards and pins. I talked to one organizer in North Carolina who'd rolled his mom's office chair down the sidewalk to man a volunteer sign-up table because the campaign didn't provide chairs. Supporters begged for lawn signs and bumper